Okay.
Jane, what is this?
Just say, yeah, so your name.
I am Terry Palmer, Vice Chair of the Building Inspector Licensing Board. I would like to call this meeting of the Building Inspector License Board to order. It is now 9:06 a.m. on November 15th. This meeting is being held in room 475 of the Hebert M. Wells Building in Salt Lake City, Utah. In compliance with the Utah open meeting laws, this meeting is being recorded in its entirety. This recording is classified as a public record. The following licensing, Building Inspector Licensing Board members are in attendance: Terry Palmer, Ed Domian, and Joseph McGorry. The following Building Inspector Licensing Board members are absent: Jennifer Youngfield. The following individuals are representing DOPPO and the Department of Commerce are in attendance: Mark Seingel.
Yes,
not here. Dan S. Jones, Board Secretary. Sharon Smalley. Nina Bowen.
Nina will not be coming today.
Not be here. Ray Walker, Regulations and Compliance Officer. Dave Furlong, Chief Investigator. Dave Taylor, Operations Manager. Carolyn Dennis, Management and Analyst. And Gordon Summers, Investigation Supervisor. We welcome all visitors and interested persons at this time. Please be sure to sign the attendance report for the meeting and identify yourself before speaking. As a courtesy to everyone participating in this meeting at this time, we ask for all cell phones, pagers, and other electronic devices to be turned off or changed to silent mode. Board motions and votes to be recorded in the minutes. Let us now proceed with the agenda. First item is to swear in new members.
That's me. We have to do this rather formally. If you'll stand and raise your right hand and repeat after me. I, having been appointed. As a member of the Building Inspector Licensing Board.
As a member of the Building Inspector Licensing Board.
Do solemnly swear. That I will support, obey, and defend.
I'll support, obey, and defend.
The Constitution of the United States.
Constitution of the United States.
And the Constitution of this state.
The Constitution of this state.
And I will discharge my duties with fidelity. Thank you, and welcome aboard. And there's the paperwork to fill out.
I think she knows the routine.
Just sign it.
Next item of business is to elect the chairman and a vice chairman.
We don't have to change, but we have to reconfirm at least once a year. So,
as a vice chair, can I make that motion?
Yes.
Make the motion that we leave the chair and the vice chair as it is.
Okay.
A second.
We normally have a vote, but it sounds like we're unanimous. We ought to take the vote. Okay. It could be formal.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Sounds like the motion is made. And here's leave the chair and the vice chair as is. Jennifer Youngfield as the chair, and Terry Palmer as the vice chair. Motion to approve minutes from September 22nd, 2015. We have a motion on that.
Motion.
To approve. Do you have a second?
I'll second.
Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Motion to approve minutes has been approved for September 2nd, 2015.
I'm going to speak to the probation list. We don't have any probationers right now. We did have one person who was on probation. He allowed his license to expire.
Okay. So
right now we don't have any. If he would were to apply for reinstatement, he's at the end of his probation term. So he may or may not come back on probation. We just don't know why he didn't apply for renewal.
Okay.
So that's the status of the probation list. We're in pretty good shape on this probation. We don't normally have a large amount.
Large list there. Okay.
He did send me an email that said he does intend to.
Oh.
But he still hasn't.
So. Oh, okay. Intend to apply for reinstatement. Okay,
mm-hmm.
Super.
Okay. Next item is division training.
And Ray is going to be responsible for that.
Okay. Mark asks to be excused. He had a matter come up, and so I step into his place as acting director when he's gone. And we are going board by board. You're one of the last several boards that we have not been to report, to turn report, if you will, on the board survey that we did last year and gather additional input from you and also respond how we are handling the input that we received. And then there were a couple of items that occurred nationally that we wanted to make sure that you've heard of and that you're aware of, because they kind of frame the national perspective. So we'll go in that direction. So I think you know that we've brought this to you, and it's our mission and your mission to protect the public and enhance commerce, and that's kind of a balancing act, because those two goals may be in conflict with one another, but if they are, then protecting the public certainly is goal number one. We can do both, like with probation, where we accommodate continued licensure while putting terms and conditions in place to protect the public. That's an example of achieving both goals. And the purpose today is to enhance our relationship with you as a board and to increase our effectiveness as a division and a board. Our agenda today is we're going to go through some introductions and roles, make sure we're clear on kind of the wiring diagram of the main functions here at Doppel, and then go over the board survey results, cover some expectations that several asked, because we've asked you what your feedback was to us. Do you have any feedback from Doppel to the board? So we'll give you a few items that the Bureau Manager shared with us about expectations, and then cover that national spotlight, a couple of items. So on wiring diagram, it's important to note that the boards and the director are appointed in the same fashion. They're nominated and then approved or confirmed by the governor. So you are your own body. Sometimes boards feel like they only exist as an arm of Doppel. And while they are advisory Doppel, they're still an independent entity of state government. And as such, you are your own body. You're appointed in the same way that Mark is appointed. And the executive director screens a list and then gets approval of the governor, and once that approval is made, she appoints with the approval of the governor. So it's important to remember, when I said you're your own body, that your minutes are your minutes, not Doppel's minutes. Your agenda is your agenda, not Doppel's agenda. Often Doppel populates a lot of the agenda because we bring the business. But whatever you want to be on the agenda can be on the agenda. Your meetings, we try and facilitate a regular meeting schedule, but if there were a need to have an additional meeting at the call of the chair and the approval of the body, then certainly you can have an additional meeting, whether it be in person like today or electronically. We facilitated a number of electronic meetings for a single issue where a matter couldn't wait and a board didn't meet Monday. You're important. I'll say this several times throughout the process. You're a very important body, because we don't have building inspectors on staff, or for that matter, any of our 50 occupations and professions that we regulate. So our expertise is our boards. And in almost every instance, the director follows the guidance and the advice of the board. If it's something that is recommended that's not in compliance with the law or speaks more of turf protection than public protection, then on those couple of instances, he'll sometimes intervene and act as prudent. But ordinarily, he will follow the direction of the boards. It's very important. Body that use that expertise and tell us how we should license applicants that are applying for licensure, how we should handle disciplinary matters, and for that matter, where we should allocate our resources between how we investigate and so forth. So I'll, that theme I'll repeat several times to make sure you understand that we really value your service. So the division is organized in this fashion. Of course, Mark Steinkel is the head of the division. A dotted line out to the side to Che Arguello, who is the Attorney General's Division Chief. He has a number of attorneys who work for him that handle the prosecution of our cases and also legal advice to the division. And this board, if it required separate legal advice or wanted separate legal advice, is entitled as a state agency to, or state body to have that legal advice. So the best way to facilitate that would be to go through Dan, and Dan would go through Mark and make a formal request to the AG's office to appoint an assistant AG to provide the legal guidance that you require on a particular matter. Then going downward, Carol Inglesby and there's also Kim Lesh are his administrative assistants. They job share. And then on the administration side, I'm the regulatory and compliance officer. I do legislation and rulemaking and presiding officer duties for citation hearings and guide the day-to-day operations of management and regulatory compliance. Dave Taylor is our operations manager. He wears lots of hats to include supervising the compliance specialists that staff your particular board and manage the probationers. And lots of other hats. David Furlong is our chief investigator. Approximately a third of the division work under his supervision. He has three investigative supervisors, one of which is here present. And the investigator that's assigned to this particular board, is there one?
Like one to work. Our investigators are divided up kind of geographically throughout the state and then call on nobody specific to this board, but to areas
like
where inspectors have responsibility.
Like in the construction industry. So there are multiple. So, Gordon, would you be the one who would normally come to this board if there were
yes.
need to?
Okay. Or if they had any questions or complaints that they needed followed up on, they could jump online and file a complaint or contact me personally at any time. So,
all right. And then Dan Jones, of course, your main people here, your bureau manager, and Sharon Small, your board secretary. Also, Carolyn Dennis is here. She's a management analyst. She graciously put together this PowerPoint presentation with a lot of input from everyone. Thank you for that. And then Nina Bowen is who comes in normally when you have probationers and gives you a compliance update on whether they're in compliance with their probationary terms or not. And then that's pretty much the wiring diagram. Okay, some professional statistics. We grouped these by the boards that Dan oversees. So a lot of it's the construction industry, but not all of it. Each bureau manager has a half dozen professions that they are responsible for. And as you can see, Bureau 4 has 12.4% of our licensees. These licensing numbers are licensing actions over a two-year time frame. So initial licensure, renewal of licensure, relicensure, reinstatement of licensure. So that's not exactly the number of licensees. Let's see, building inspectors, we have currently licensed 663 licensed building inspectors. So you can see the number of actions, and then the building inspector must have had a few additional actions than renewals here. That's the number of actions we had over the past 2 years. Then on the opposite side, licensure, and now the disciplinary side, for that same group, here are the investigative and disciplinary actions for the division as a whole, and then for this Bureau 4. And as you can see, this Bureau 4 is responsible for a large number of the total number of complaints based on the construction industry being a very loud voice and having lots of investigators who the legislature has funded for the construction industries. And there's lots of actions we can take, from citations, and you see 1,385, that's almost half of the total number of citations were in this profession. Administrative actions, 40 letters of concern. Letters of concern are non-disciplinary ways of closing a case, articulating that if we did press forward, it probably is a violation, and there's some concern, but we've chosen not to move forward. And keep it as an intelligence file should it become a pattern. Unfounded or lack of evidence, that's one of our more common outcomes, actually, when we look at it, and it really doesn't have a basis, or there's not at least a violation. And then, of course, this number of probationers, but none currently for your particular profession. I'm going to do a lot of talking right now, but then we're going to ask for your input as we get to the board survey results, which is coming right up. Your role is to collaborate and provide us the expertise that we don't possess, and that's super important. In the statute, it actually outlines your duties and responsibilities. These are good to review from time to time. You advise the division by screening applicants, and you define for this profession which applications you want brought before the board. Some boards see all applications, some boards see very few applications, depending upon how much consistency there is with what an application looks like and how much expertise we would require as a division. And if all applications are kind of similar, then a lot of boards will tell the division these kinds that are unique bring to the board. The rest, as division staff, just process those and brief us on the numbers. So you define that for us.
But just for this board, will we bring applicants that have criminal history to the board for their review? The ones that normally meet the criteria is pretty straightforward, so that's there. So we review those, and as you can see from the last board meeting being more than a year ago, we only bring those when we see them, and we don't see an awful lot with this profession. Given the size of the profession, and it's also a profession that is pretty clean in terms of not having problems.
Yeah, you're an enforcer as a building inspector. You're part of, you wouldn't expect there to be a criminal history in that element.
Right.
Disciplinary participation. When we have hearings, you serve as the jury, the blue ribbon jury, of sitting in for resolution of matters by your peers. Of course, most of our actions are stipulated and settled, and with the stipulations, we have the ability to contact one member of your board that you designate, either on a continuous basis or on a rotation basis. We don't always need to contact a member of your board. It depends on whether there's something where we need the expertise, but that's how we try and tap in the board without involving, because that board member would have to recuse himself if it went to a hearing without tainting the entire board should it go to a hearing. When the matters are stipulated, then we share those with the board, and if the board is concerned that we settled a case with terms and conditions that weren't appropriate, then you should express that to the division so we can change course. So you would always have input. Even when cases are settled, if we settle one, we think we have precedent, so we're doing it like the board would have done it at some point in the past. But if we get feedback from you that that's not what the case should have been resolved for, then we'll change course. So we always need your input, whether it's at a hearing or even with cases that settle. You establish the standards that we apply, rulemaking, really your expertise goes into those rules as much or more so than the division's understanding and knowledge of rulemaking. We write lots of rules, but when it comes to the specifics of your profession, we bring proposals here or a draft here, and then you prune it and finish it so that it meets your profession and is on target. But most importantly down here, you help us steer, if you will. You're the navigator or the helmsman, and you help us steer so that we apply the right resources to licensing, to investigation, and that if there are frustrations in the industry, they don't just keep churning and getting worse and worse. We identify them early on and address them to your satisfaction and make sure that the industry is happy or at least understanding of and content with the regulatory body so that we have respect and good communication. All right, so now to the survey. Lots of hands, and we did get a good response. What was our response, Ray, overall? And just,
I think Bureau had 17 responses.
Okay, and overall we had?
Over 250.
250 responses out of about 400 board members. So pretty good response, and there are some themes, as you'll see here. And we want to ask you to share, as we go through these next slides, whether you agree or disagree with what they represent for this profession grouping. So first, a soft question about what you like. And this group said you like serving the public and helping the profession, which was pretty common throughout all of our survey results. But is that what you would agree with? Is kind of where you enjoy spending your time and applying your talents?
I think so.
Okay, let's go to the other side then. What do you enjoy least? And this group of professions have consequences when licensees make poor decisions. I don't know if that means that there's not a good fit for holding them responsible exactly or what that is precisely. Not knowing all the laws and rules, and it looks like scheduling conflicts. Well tied with parking and being an advisory board only. We're going to talk about that. It actually turns out to be a very good thing given one of the national precedents by the Supreme Court of the United States. We're going to talk about that at the end. Comments about what you enjoy least or things that tend to frustrate you with regard to your service as a board member?
I think, like it says there, the biggest thing is telling somebody they can't get a license to do a job, partly because of their choices they've made.
Yeah, when an applicant comes in and they have a criminal background and they think it's a different them when it happened than they are now, but there's a definite pattern there and not a lot of time has passed, but sometimes you have to say, well, that's good and we hope that's the case, but we need to monitor it as the body that ensures public protection to make sure that it is the case.
Yeah.
Good. Okay. Let's see about applying resources, whether we're focused appropriately with this group of professions when asked what behaviors are most harmful to the public. They identified unethical behavior as the lead item. Incompetence is the next item, and then the rest drop way off: false advertising, fraud, misuse of funds, financial responsibility. Are those for building inspectors, unethical behavior and incompetence, would those be kind of the two lead behaviors or areas of concern for licensees?
Yeah,
I think so.
Mm-hmm.
I would could seem to match for building inspectors. They're a very professional group, but on occasion you had an inspector who slides, lets their skill set lapse, or is affected by influences that they ought not be affected by, or whatever. Okay, so if those are the two lead behaviors that are important for us to stay focused on, we ask this group of professions, so what amount of your time do we give them focused on those behaviors? We sort of got two different answers here. That's interesting. A bell curve over here with six, seven, eight, nine responses. It says most of our time is focused right there. But then there was this group over here with a big chunk of five who said, no, only 10% of our time is focused on those behaviors that are most important. I don't know if that's the construction industry side or the building inspector side or some of Dan's other profession side. You have issues with your profession where you think we're not focused on those behaviors which are most important to protecting the public with your profession?
I think where we're at, we focus on the ones that are critical to those two.
Good.
The ones that we see.
So you think this would be...
Where we're at.
It's just not that many. So that's why I think that bar on the left is so high. We don't see that many. You can't create them. You know?
That's probably true. So. Yeah. Okay. Then we asked, when we discipline people, are we on target with how we discipline them? And 93% said, just about right. There was just a few who said, a little lenient. How do you feel about our stiffs and orders and matters that go to a hearing or matters that are resolved by citations? Are we on target with the amount of discipline?
I think so.
Then we asked, do we change the rules about right or too often or too seldom? And I know this group is a very black and white, very vigilant, very, we want to have good definition kind of group. So I would assume that your rules, if there's an issue, you're not bashful about addressing that issue. 53% said we changed the rules about right. I mean, it was kind of an equal amount. 17% said too often and not often enough. Do you have any insights about rule changes?
From the time I've been here, I think it's about right because it's pretty black and white what needs to be done, what they need to follow.
Right. So. And you have a good bureau manager who's black and white oriented too.
Yeah.
And knows how to draft rules, being an attorney is part of his skill set.
Most of the time when we've had to update rules for the building inspector community, it's been resulting in changes in the legislature, and we've formulated the rules to match up with what the legislature has done.
I remember the days when we had a multitude of license classifications and the change to having a combo license or a license merited by passing one of the certifications for that type of inspection only seems to have worked well. It certainly streamlined and simplified licensure and doesn't seem to have impacted our ability to regulate the group.
Yeah. Building inspection. I think most people comply with that without any issue whatsoever. And go get the next, if they want to inspect in another area, go get the certification. So I think that's been followed pretty closely.
We've heard the theme recently a little bit about the profession not being able to recruit replacements for an aging licensing group.
Right. We've talked a little bit about the way it's set up now. You have four residential tests, four commercial tests, and I was here when all of this began. From day one, when Dave Robinson was in there, when they were fighting down at the legislature.
I was here too.
And And so we thought we were doing a profession a favor, saying, you know, you can just go after the residential if you just want residential. And also it was an easier way for a guy to learn how to pass these exams. But now we're in a position where we don't have much of a hiring pool. And we've looked at the books, and we've talked with the Bonneville chapter, and we've talked with the Utah chapter, and they both agree that maybe this is something we should discuss, that if you have the four commercials, you should be good for everything, because what's in the residential, probably 95% at least, is in the commercial book.
Yeah, I think it merits certainly exploring or reexamination as to the reasons why we don't have a good hiring pool. Is it because the compensation isn't what they can get going to other professions, and so we're not recruiting them because we're not paying them the kind of compensation that is competitive? Or is it because we put restraints in place that make it too hard to get licensed? You know, there have to be reasons there for that pool to have dried up a bit.
Part of it is just population. Part of it is, but a lot of it is when a contractor or a journeyman or a tradesman asks us, how do you get in the profession? I said, well, you got to pass at least four exams for us to really get our worth, because we can't have a guy sitting in the office because he can't do anything.
Right.
Because we can only keep him busy, you know, 10% of the time, 20% of the time. And when they look at that, it's daunting, and they don't think they can do it. They think it's too expensive to do it. The ones that are going up the ladder, they go to this new, I call it, this is terrible, shake and bake class that comes through, what, a couple times a year, maybe twice a year? Mm-hmm. For every category, if I want to go in there and have them prepare me to take an exam, it's about $1,000.
Pretty expensive.
Out of their pocket.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you're looking at $8,000 to get to the top of the food chain there?
And the cities or counties wouldn't foot that bill.
Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. You know?
The majority of them will not pay that one.
And so if you have the four categories that are good for everything, why would you make them go through all eight?
Right.
And that's the argument. And we just think it needs more discussion and consideration.
Well, I agree.
It's not that we're trying to make it easy.
It's an important consideration that we have well-qualified but enough building inspectors, because it's where the rubber hits the road, particularly with those initial four-way inspections and things. If there's not someone there to serve as the stop gap or the final body that gives or doesn't give approval, you catch a lot of things, and you can't guarantee that everything is in accordance with the building codes, but you can catch a lot of things. And, you know, buildings that, particularly buildings that are being built by an owner-builder or a less than competent contractor, they need to redo work that doesn't meet code. The code's there for a reason.
What we're doing now is stealing from each other. When we do advertise, and I've just been through this a couple of times, trying to get more people on our staff or people that have retired, the only candidates you get are not qualified, or they have one. And so what do? You reach out and you look around and you see who may not be happy working for this jurisdiction or this, and try to recruit them. And so we're stealing from each other, so the problem doesn't get any better.
I know the legislature was looking at it last year. They didn't come up with good solutions. All right, well, we'll move on. But we're certainly observant and wanting to help in that area to the degree we can. I want to be included in the conversation and help find solutions. All right, so we asked your group of professionals, if we were to train your board members, what areas, what subjects would increase your effectiveness? And this was a real theme. These big three here came out loud and strong with everybody. The Brown one, orientation for new board members. Typically in the past, we've given the new board members a manual, and then they've learned as they have gone along, which isn't terribly effective. Blue, the rules, statutes, and regulations that are pertinent to your board. I would think your group might not have as big a concern with that one as some others. The building inspectors seem to know their stuff as well as any group of licensees. And then the green, basic do's and don'ts about being a board member, how to close a meeting, how to make a motion, how to conduct a probationary interview, those sorts of things. So do you agree with those three areas, if you have training being kind of the critical areas?
I think so. Because you hit it. We're given a new book when we put you on the board, and here's this book, start reading it.
Right.
State statute's not easy to read anyway, but Dan's been great on the board to help us as we get into these meetings and try to give us the outlines and the highlights, what we need to look at, what to follow. But yeah, I think these are the areas that would be good with more training.
Okay, well, in response to that, it being one of the common themes and biggest themes of this particular board survey, the last board survey we did, we do them every 4 years to try and hit every board member at least once during their service. The theme back then was probation isn't working. We put a bunch of tools in place to include the making probation, having more compliance specialists, having authority to issue citations to probationers, making the probation process violations of probation informal, so they come before the board but not in a hearing, just as an agenda item. We did a lot of things to streamline and make more effective probation. So that theme didn't come through loud and strong this time, but this one did. And what we've targeted are three areas where we think we can do better and we're committed to do better. First, on new board members. Number one, we're asking for the bureau manager and the board chair to find an opportunity when a new board member comes to their first meeting to pull them aside either before the meeting or after the meeting and spend a half an hour or an hour with them one-on-one, answering their questions and outlining their major responsibilities, do's and don'ts, but some personal time with them at their first board meeting. Secondly, we think that the training manual, while a tool, is not the most effective tool, and so instead of the training manual, we're going to put the training manual online, but put it in modules that people can select a topic and quickly, in a matter of 5 minutes, in a learning curve or learning method that is kind of the method that people prefer, go online, watch a video or watch a PowerPoint on that topic and get the scoop and not lose your attention span. So Carolyn is overtraining as well as other items, and she already has a half dozen of those done. And now that we're just about done with doing these return report trainings to our boards, we'll focus on that more heavily. So that will be the direction you can go in the future as a new board member. The online modules, very easy to use, very informative. You can do them as you have time, fit them in, and not lose your attention span with this big book that gets daunting. Final thing is we want to incorporate a better attitude of or tradition of training as a board. Any company or any state agency or any body that has been around very long does training whenever they meet, or they have a regular kind of a training process. So we're asking that the boards put on their agenda each meeting a training topic, so that when you meet, you ask each of the board members, okay, what should be our next training topic? And some of the training topics would be best handled by a member of your own board or a member of the industry that someone knows is good in that particular area. Some of the trainers would be better from Doppel, depending on what the training topic is. And we have a little bit of funding. We could bring in a professional from the university or something if it were necessary. So we're asking that you, going forward, give a little bit of time to sharpening your tools rather than just trying to hurry through an agenda. Make sure that your agenda stops for long enough, whether that's 10 minutes, or half an hour, or an hour, and does a training item that you wanted, that you think is relevant, that helps you be better as board members and better in your profession. So those are the three initiatives that we think will help the area of training. Any feedback on that? Does that hit the mark, do you think?
Well, the orientation, you know, from against that, from the other boards, it's been pretty poor.
Yes.
He said, you know, when I show up to be a representative of the citizens or representative of the public, you know, I'm not in a profession. I'm there as a public, you know, electrician's board, and I've had to learn a lot on my own. But as a DOPPO commissioner also, you know, it's like, okay, I'm up against a lot of commissioners who are in their professions. I sit here as a public guy, and sometimes I'm a little outspoken because the public needs to be defended, and common sense to me as a public member is common sense, but to the professionals, it's their profession, they're trying to do their work with it. So I think orientation, hopefully, will be better.
Yes.
And the basic do's and don'ts is the other thing as a board member is, what can you do? Sometimes I call Gordon and say, Gordon, am I allowed to say this, or can I do this, or am I within black and white? Sometimes in our meetings, when we go into a closed session, I have to bring stuff up to say, man, you know, what can we, I mean, you know, something's going wrong out there. I mean, what do we do?
Right.
I mean, as a public, but you don't want to offend professionals on the board, but still you need to bring it up and say, look, I think you guys are wrong here. This is a viewpoint of the public. It becomes tough because I'm just not in the professions and I'm catching up on it, but
right.
My background has me in some, just not all of it together.
Well taken, and you're right. The public member has a learning curve that's distinctly different than the members of the profession. But we don't expect the public member, of course, to be the professional. We expect them to be the public voice, but in order to be an informed public voice, you have to know enough about the profession to be an effective public member. And if you come and there's nothing organized in terms of training for you, and it's just learn as you go, however you can scramble to figure it out, that's not optimal at all. So these three methods, hopefully pulling you aside as a chair and a bureau manager on your first meeting date, less important for you because you've served on multiple boards, but still, with this board, there are some things that are unique and things that are sensitivities that you would want to understand and that the board would want to, at the outset, make you aware of. And then if we do a good job of these modules, then sometimes the board may select one of the modules for your board training item, and making training a theme for each of your board meetings, that particularly for the public member, they can get up to speed more easily with both the modules and having a regular training item on each of your board agendas. So that's how we're approaching it, and we'd like your guidance as we go along. If we're still not hitting the target, let us know. If you have some other suggestions, let us know. Okay. So we ranked what was in those items, and of course it's just another way of saying the same thing. The theme was training. And this is, I said we hit up multiple times, this is just to remind you that we need your expertise, and this is what you do, it's what you do because you have the skill set to do it better so than Doppel does. Very, very important. Some expectations. So we asked the bureau managers, the director did, he sent an email around and said, okay, what would you like to tell the board members? We asked for their input, and several of them said, well, what's your input? And it wasn't earth-shattering at all. It was pretty predictable what they said. They said, well, we would like board members to come to a board meeting informed and prepared. Meaning that if you sent a board packet out, they didn't open it up when they arrived at the meeting. They opened it up and they read it before they came to the meeting. and they said that they wanted board members who were active participants in the process. They didn't sit there silently throughout the meeting, but they participated actively and attentively as a board member. There was an expression that we avoid the conflict of interest between hats that we wear, that if you're a member of your professional association, that's good and we would like you to be, but we don't want a board member to simultaneously be a board member and an officer in the association, because that becomes a conflict of interest. The association is there to protect the best interests of the profession. The board is here to protect the public, and while those two may be not mutually exclusive, sometimes they are mutually exclusive. There are conflicts between those two objectives. So not only is DAPL, but in national codified ethics for boards, they avoid that conflict of interest as well. If you have to choose between being an executive or an officer in the professional association or being on the board, no problem to be a member and an active participant in the professional association, but when it comes to being in the management of that professional association as opposed to being on the board and selecting one or the other. So basically, the reasons in the statute, and those Mark always covers them here, for which a board member can be removed, include one, not attending board meetings, that's not once or twice, but just kind of falling off the bandwagon and never coming anymore. Having the conflict of interest that we just mentioned, or not having an active license, or having discipline against your license. And we've encountered those where a person had an investigation and they were coming to the board for a hearing, and yet they were a board member on the board and they wouldn't resign their position on the board. And it was very sensitive, and we got a resolve, fortunately, before the board met, but it led to a change in the statute which gave the executive director the power to remove a board member if, A, they didn't keep an active license in the profession, if they held a position that was for a licensee, or B, their license was disciplined and they didn't maintain an active and good standing license, and C, if they just failed to attend and participate in the meetings. So those are the expectations. And now to the national spotlight. Last year was a banner year in terms of licensing being on the forefront both of the president and the Supreme Court, so the executive branch and the judicial branch. First, the judicial branch. There was a case that made it all the way to the Supreme Court. It wasn't your profession, but it was a profession. It was the North Carolina Board of Dental Examiners, and as a board, they met and they put on their agenda their concerns about people doing teeth whitening in kiosks at malls, and it became apparent that they were more concerned about eliminating competition than they were about protecting the public, which was evident from the fact that they had no complaints about the teeth whitening that was occurring in the kiosks. There had been no reports of any public harm, and yet it was taking part of their business. And so as a board, and they were an independent board or an autonomous board, not an advisory board like you, so they had the power, they told staff, go out and issue cease and desist orders to every kiosk that is in the state that is situated out there doing this teeth whitening. And it wasn't even clear in the licensing act that the teeth whitening in this fashion was the practice of dentistry. So they forthwith issued cease and desist orders to all of those licensees, and then a national group got involved that funds litigation when anti-competitive issues are noted, and that group forward of the litigation until it went all the way to the Supreme Court. It was an antitrust, a Sherman antitrust issue, and the issue was whether or not the board had immunity from lawsuit as a state actor. And typically, the immunity was all-encompassing and there was never any question about its coverage. The Supreme Court in here in this case said, we think the precedent needs to be changed, and there's still going to be a broad umbrella of immunity from lawsuit, but there are going to be some exceptions where that umbrella won't cover you. And they said, one of two circumstances has to be in place for that umbrella to still cover you. Either A, your board isn't comprised of a majority of active market participants. How many boards do you know that don't have a majority of licensees? They all do, almost. So either you had to restructure your board so that you had a majority who were non-market participants, public members, or B, there had to be active, there had to be oversight by a state agency. So that the market participants have active state oversight by a state agency. So Doppel fell right into that model because that's already the way we were organized. Boards were advisory and the policymaker was Doppel, and Doppel did actively exercise oversight over its advisory bodies. Still, our legislature met in two full interims to go through every board in the state. They only found one that potentially needed to be changed in Doppel, and that was our State Construction Services Commission, where the State Construction Services Commission is designated by statute differently than our other boards. It is the policymaker, but their actions require concurrence by the director. So the legislature asked the question of, okay, and if there isn't concurrence, then who takes priority? And they changed that body to say, if there's disagreement and the disagreement can't be resolved, then the division director would have the final say in order to overcome the issues by this North Carolina Board of Dental Examiners versus the FTC case. So we've all been as Doppel staff to a lot of national board meetings, and I presume some of you have. You may have heard of this case, but it's been just the talk of every national meeting you go to, because most of the boards are not organized like Doppel's boards, and so they're scurrying to change their structure to bring themselves under somebody's active state oversight. Some of them have put themselves under a state agency like we are. Some of them have all of their actions now being reviewed by the State Attorney General's office, but they have to come under one of those two methods or they won't be protected with state immunity from actions as a board member. So there's good spotlight, more spotlight than there ever has been before on state licensing agencies. The other half of this was, at the same time this was happening, the president asked his Council of Economic Advisors to look at licensing. And they did, and they published a report. That report, of course, is only a guidance document. But the report said we need a 20th century licensing scheme, and we don't have one. The licensing scheme that we have is kind of antiquated, and it doesn't adequately deal with a number of concerns, like mobility of licensees between states, like addressing military members and their spouses who routinely have reassignments, and the ability of those spouses to work in each state as they arrive without having to get relicensed, like the incarcerated element of society and having a pathway back into the professions by the incarcerated element, from the incarcerated element, instead of being excluded for the duration because they have a criminal background. And they had lots of themes. They were basically asking states to explore and re-examine licensing. They started with the proposition that we have good empirical evidence that licensing raises the cost to the consumer. What we don't have good empirical licensing of, and empirical evidence of, is whether licensing actually protects the public and is worth the regulation that we put in place. And I think there's a lot of evidence out there, there hasn't been a good method of gathering that evidence. But the president is about commerce, FTC is about commerce and having a free flow of commerce, and the president was looking at it and saying it raises costs, and yet we're not sure that it raises benefits. And so you need to look at it, and maybe licensing isn't what's necessary in some professions. Maybe registration or certification would be adequate. Maybe not all professions require licensing. The report looked at the growth of licensing, and it was a steep curve, and some states had a couple of hundred professions that they were licensing, where if you went back 40 years ago, there were, you know, a dozen or so professions on average that were being licensed. So there was a really steep curve of the number of professions that were being regulated by the state. So the question was being asked, is it necessary? Is it protecting the public, or is it protecting the profession? Is it just costing consumers, or is it benefiting consumers? So there's a lot of spotlight and focus, both in the executive branch and the judicial branch, on licensing, which makes it prudent for us as DOPL and as board members to be very vigilant now when we see licensing concerns, to make sure that we're focused on the right priorities, and to make sure that we have a sound basis for doing what we're doing, so that we don't get in the crosshairs of the Federal Trade Commission or our own state legislature or the governor or the President of the United States in initiatives to take out the licensing that's in place because it isn't serving the best interest of the public. So it's a major focus where it hasn't been such or so much so in the past.
So is that going to shift now, you think?
I think the pendulum is still way swung out there on the examination of licensing, whether it serves the public interest or whether it's swung so far that it's anti-competitive and needs to be right-sized. So there are a lot of state legislatures re-examining by way of sunset, sunrise committees, how many professions they regulate, and deciding not to regulate as many as they have regulated in the past because some don't need to be regulated. The public can protect themselves, and the profession was just really a restraint on how many people could get into the marketplace, but it wasn't doing the public a lot of good. So we just need to be really tuned into that. I think we're in a good place as a state. We've been pretty conservative. We don't have as many professions regulated as many states. We already have the right scheme that the FTC put in place as a mandate for the other states. And our mission statement is to protect the public and to enhance commerce, so we're always trying to find that balance. But we need to be focused on that maybe as much as we ever have been in the past, because the national spotlight is upon that from two branches of government. Questions or observations about that?
I just know this whole thing started when Governor Banger said there's people in the inspection business that have no business being in that business. And that's when he started the whole certification law.
Yeah.
The contractors were tired of having one set of rules in one town, another set of rules in another town, and everybody, you know, misinterpreted things, and there was a lot of competency that wasn't there.
We heard lots of those complaints in the distant past, but the complaints have really dimmed over time. Mm-hmm. Consistency has become much better.
And on the contractor side, you know, it's rare that you're not going to find things when you inspect these buildings, and some of it comes from when, like now, contractors are so busy, they've got so much going on up and down the Wasatch Front that maybe the supervisors that we're dealing with are not so good. And you get guys that come in and they'll say, oh, I'm going to be a contractor. I'm going to test the market. I'm going to try building in West LA City, see how it goes.
Right.
And so we get all kinds of people. I get the one frustrating thing that I've had is there doesn't seem to be a system in place here where if I catch a guy without a license, what you guys can do to him. And what I've heard in the past is if he has a license, we can do things to him. But if he doesn't have a license, we have no leverage.
We can cite them for working without a license, or we can sting them with a fine.
Are you talking about where they've done something that they're not licensed and they've violated a code, and then correcting that and bringing it up to a safe standard?
For example, a guy went knocking on doors down a city street and started telling people he could put up carports really cheap. And there was a reason he could do it really cheap. And in some cases, they would just take the bulk of the money up front, barely start. And you've seen more of this than I have. And they never see the contractor again. And there is not a licensed contractor.
Yeah, we're very active in those kind of complaints. We're on that right now.
You've been good about filing complaints in the past, and so if they're contracting without a license and taking money, we'll file on those, not only issue administrative citation or oftentimes not issue an administrative citation, but just file criminal charges on those, especially if they're taking money and not doing any work.
And we've gotten good participation from the county prosecutors.
Yeah, they've come on board with us a lot more in recent years.
And we'll include our Division of Consumer Protection because they have more ability to make the consumer whole. While Bob can stop the unlicensed contractor, Consumer Protection can help make the consumer whole. So I think we're pretty aggressive in that arena. We're funded much better in the construction areas than we are with other professions. Other professions will. Two or three professions will share one investigator. In the contractor profession, we have nine investigators that do construction and building inspection type work.
And we get very few complaints against legitimate contractors from their customers. But 75% of the complaints that we get, quite frankly, we can't keep up with the complaints we get. That's usually 75%, I know this number because the mayor made me give it to him, comes from neighbors complaining about neighbors doing work without permits and look how shoddy it looks and look what it's doing to my neighborhood. And they finish their basement, they turn their house into an apartment, and there's just no end to that. So on that, what I'm trying to say is, we are doing things the public wants us to do when we pursue things like that. And quite frankly, we can't even keep up with it. There's right. So much of it.
And you're right. You have the jurisdiction over that area more so than Doppel does, because if I don't get a building permit, that's not something we enforce. That's the compliance agency that enforces it. If they don't build to standards, that's not something we enforce. We assist the Uniform Building Code Commission in establishing what the codes are for the entire state, but the compliance agency does the codes enforcement. If they're not licensed, well, then we certainly get involved in that in a big way, but some don't have to be licensed. Owner builders, if they're appropriately doing that, they may not do it well. And again, it's the compliance agency that oversees how well they do it, but we're not the compliance agency, and we don't oversee the compliance agency, except that we license the building inspectors who work for the compliance agency.
But we can only go after them because of the rules that are on the books because of the state.
True.
And we do get cases, and this is something that probably some in the building inspector industry could be maybe a little more educated on, that when they get a licensee who is not building to code, and they've given that licensee a correction order, and the licensee fails to comply with that correction order, those should be forwarded to Doppel, to us.
That's a pattern.
With the inspection report, with the correction order, and with some kind of a report that kind of outlines what happens and that the licensee was given notice to correct and failed to correct. What is helpful in those cases, too, to us is if the local compliance agency, the inspector, gives that licensee a kind of a date certain to have it corrected by. Because what we'll get sometimes is when it does come to us in that fashion, well, I've always intended to comply with that. I'll do it. And then they get out and they get it done. But if the inspector's given a reasonable date, if it's something that's really, really dangerous, if it's a shock or fire hazard, you know, and it's kind of immediate within 24 hours or whatever, and you stop work until that's fixed or whatever, that's one thing. If it's something that depends on weather and you're in the middle of the winter and whatever, and you give them 30, 60 days or whatever, that's another thing. But what's helpful to us and what should be brought to our attention, we've taken action on a few. Most, I bet 90% of those cases that come to us that way. Some agencies are better than others about bringing those to our attention. I would say 90% of them. Usually, if an investigator, if it comes to us and then I assign it to an investigator, the first call is back to the building official and say, okay, he's violated your corrective order and he hasn't complied in the time period you've given him. You gave him 10 days. Now it's come to us. What we usually do, our protocol is, you still got a license, the work still needs to be brought up to code. It's easier for the homeowner in most cases and the builder and the inspector and everybody to keep the same people involved. We'll give them another, tell us, inspector, how many days is reasonable for him to comply again? 10 days again, 5, whatever. And then we'll give him that and say, if you don't have it completed in that time period, then we're going to file for a notice of agency action. Then we work with Dan and his group on it. And then some end up with on probation, and others end up surrendering their license because it might be way too costly. But most get it fixed. Most do get it fixed at that point. And so then we'll, depending on the severity of the circumstances, may close it with a letter of concern. So we can start documenting a pattern, and so that if it continues in other jurisdictions or whatever, that you know better how to judge that conduct as it goes forward. Most correct it, most get it done. And so sometimes we'll, if they're so cooperative and there was a misunderstanding or somebody posted the, and we can't prove otherwise, the correction order out on the job site, they never gave it to them personally. It's like, whoa, you know, I didn't know. And so sometimes we'll close those just voluntary compliance, as they voluntarily comply. But just so you're aware, that's kind of the process and what we see as investigations, and where maybe we could be a helpful tool to the local compliance agencies in getting compliance out of some contractors that are dragging their feet.
We did, just as an example, we did revoke a license of a contractor. I think it was at the September meeting that we ordered the revocation. They didn't comply with an order, building compliance order. When we did our court search, there actually was a judgment the consumer got against the contractor in another jurisdiction. They obtained a judgment for failure to comply with the code, so they had a judgment. And we filed a notice of agency action. They did not respond, and we ended up revoking that license. And so you know, while you may have only saw one of those in a jurisdiction, we actually saw it was a pattern because we saw the judgment come from another jurisdiction where the same issues of failure to comply with the building codes, get an engineering drawing for the construction that was happening.
I don't mean to talk too much, but just one other area where we can be helpful is you have jurisdiction as inspectors for the code. You can't really order them to exceed the code, and nor can we. And one thing that's helpful to us is that sometimes on workmanship, a local compliance agency, it may not be called, but they'll tell the person called Doppel, they can help you with this. And we can't, because our statute clearly says we don't have any jurisdiction over workmanship, unless it goes through you first and it's a health, safety, welfare issue that's documented, can be enforced through the code. So what happens sometimes, and you're well aware of this better than I am, is you'll get a correction order that may be given to a contractor and the homeowner says, I don't want him back out on my house, on my job site, to do these fixes. I've had a gut full of them. I'm tired of them. Well, that ties your hands and it ties our hands because they're not willing to let the licensee fix his own work. They could use your inspection report in a civil case against him, and many do, but it ties their hands and it ties our hands. We also have some where the contractor, when we get involved, it's been forwarded to us. I had one of these, I've had several of these, but one from Salt Lake City that came in a while back, where I contacted the contractor and they said, we have this correction order from the city and you need to get it taken care of or we're going to be making taking action against your license. And he says, I have tried to get it taken care of and the homeowner won't let me out on the job site to do it unless I do it this way. They'll only let me do it this way, and that's beyond code, and it will cost me way more money, and all I'm willing to do is bring it up to code. And but they are willing to bring it up to code. That also puts it in the civil court, because they are not allowing that contractor to come out and repair or fix to bring it up to code. And so what I'm saying, going with this, is sometimes you have that weight on your shoulders. I think, Ed, we've had one in the past, way back in the days, where we had to explain to a homeowner we can only enforce the code, not beyond code, because they wanted something that was more than what code required. And so we can be helpful, I guess, somewhat in that to help explain if you're getting a lot of heat from a homeowner that way. We don't like to necessarily be the bearers of bad news, but we can help in explaining to the customers or your clients, your constituents, whatever, your citizens in your areas that inspectors only have jurisdiction to the code and DOPL only has jurisdiction to the health, safety, and welfare aspects of the code. And so if you expect more than that, it becomes a civil situation. You can use all your pictures, you can use all your inspection reports that it's not up to code. Because there's been some ways, I'm rattling on here, but I have to admit there's been some ways where the contractor said, I will bring this up to code and this is how I'm going to do it. And it would look terrible, but it would satisfy code. And as a homeowner, I wouldn't want it done that way either because it would look terrible. But looks and aesthetics and cosmetics are not necessarily code or health, safety, welfare issues.
There's a new problem we see, and it goes back to solar. And you'll have a reputable company come in and pull a permit. I mean, they're pulling tons of permits. 100 a month is nothing just for solar. And the reputable contractor will come in, his property, credentials, license, he pulls a solar permit, you go out to do an inspection, it's a totally different company, you may or may not have heard of, may or may not be credentialed. That's a big problem, and we're not quite sure how to handle that.
Yeah. So if they're using an unlicensed guy to do the work, we can deal with the unlicensed aspect of it. As far as my personal opinion is, if they're the ones who came in and pulled the permit, they have a license for the permit they pulled, you wouldn't give them a permit,
mm-hmm.
That's who you give the correction order to. If they created the problem by hiring people who are not qualified, or even if they were, but they did shoddy work, their names on the permit, it's their license that the permit was issued to. My personal opinion would be they're the ones who made that representation to you as a local compliance agency, that they were the ones doing the work or responsible for the work being done, and they put their license and their name on the line. That's who I would give the correction order to, and let them fight it out with whoever they hired, whether it's civilly or whether they want to hire somebody else to come in and do it right. And then the same thing would apply. If they don't comply with the correction order, send it to us.
But what about the legal side of them subbing that out to somebody that isn't licensed?
Who is not licensed?
Yes.
Again, we would go after, Mr. Walker's kind of already hit on this and talked about this, we would go after the person who hired the unlicensed company,
mm-hmm.
and we would go after the unlicensed company. Our jurisdiction pretty much ends with we can issue fines and cease and desist orders. We do not have the authority to order them to repay anything or to, and you can't really give a correction order to somebody who's not licensed to do the work in the first place.
But consumer protection sometimes has some additional leverage, and criminal prosecution sometimes has some additional leverages.
Right.
And what's fueling this is there's such a demand that that company thinks they can handle it, but then they realize they can't because they have too many customers.
Or like
so then
any
they
other,
start subbing it out.
Yeah, they're like any other contractor. They can do the work or they can sub it out and superintend. A sub can be a general.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they're becoming is a general. And subbing it out, but they're supposed to sub it out to licensees.
I'd put it back on them. They're the ones who came in and applied for the permit, made themselves responsible for that work by doing so.
They contracted with the homeowner and they put themselves on the permit. Whether they choose to do it or sub it out is their choice, but they're the responsible party contractually and with the city.
Let them satisfy you, and then if they need satisfaction from whoever they subbed it to, they can take them to court and back charge them or whatever else they need to do. But they're the ones who subbed that out and hired it. And they're the ones who put their name and their license on the line, on the permit, as far as doing the work and doing it correctly to meet code. That's how I look at it. And I think that's how the law backs us up as far as with us taking jurisdiction and working and trying to get some kind of resolution to that.
First-hand involvement in what you just described. I recently had solar put in, a nice reputable company, but when the installers came, they were contractual installers.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
I had that similar one with the, when we re-sited our house. The main group that did the bid and took the bid, and then all of a sudden these other companies showed up. I said, wait a minute.
Who are you?
Subs. I said, well, and they didn't know I was on the boards or anything. I just asked them for their licenses. I said, show me your licenses. And they all did, and they were all professional. I mean, I lucked out. But it was back to the one group.
Yes.
And any problems I had, I didn't talk to the subs. I went to the one group and said, you hold the license. You pulled the licenses from Sandy City.
And I contracted
everything
with you.
And I contracted with you, nobody else, right? And he says,
right.
Yeah, that's right. So I had no problems, but yeah, they showed up and it's like, well, we're here to do your siding, but you're not the company. No, we're part of the company, we'll kind of a sub.
Yeah.
And that's the way it went with rain gutters and everything. It's just like, whoa.
Okay, well, I think we've taken more than our share of time. Any other final observations or comments? Where are we needed to, any other agenda you have?
No, I appreciate it.
Okay, can you excuse Mark? You would have been a better presenter, but I didn't check.
The one thing that always came up in the other boards, I don't know if this board knows it, but when you email each other,
it can be an electronic meeting.
Could be a meeting without authorizations.
Right.
So,
we send out a board packet, and we expect you to digest that board packet and come to the meeting to have your discussion and make your decisions. If you start an email chain and do that discussion and make your decisions before the meeting, that's inappropriate.
Mm-hmm.
And I ran into that a couple of times. Being new to some of the boards, I'd ask questions or ask the chairman, then send it out to the whole board, then I'd get back. You can't do that because you're holding the meeting.
Right.
Okay, I didn't. I just thought it was a friendly question.
Well,
I guess you get so many, then you have meetings.
Right. The discussion and the decision-making is occurring outside of a public forum. There's a way to have an electronic meeting where you can stay in place and just make a phone call for a single issue and do it appropriately if the need arises, so you don't have to come here and do it in this sequence. We've had a couple of occasions where we had a hard stipulation or a hard license application, and you weren't scheduled to meet for a long time, but we really needed that input on that single issue, so we sent a packet, and at a designated time, it was only a half an hour meeting or whatever, we've done an electronic meeting so as to conserve your time and energy, but to get the input we needed. So we can do that. Dan knows how to do that well. All right, well, if nothing else, thank you so much for your service again and again and again, and we'll continue forward.
Thank you.
All right.
Yeah, we don't have anything further from us on our side.
Nothing else.
That's the end of the meeting then.
Good.
I can do adjourn.
It's now 10:25.
And this meeting can be adjourned.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Thank you all.
Thank you.
You're an important group.